Morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're starting off today's program with a toast, more or less.
Are we? Pretty much.
to the great, wonderful, wild world of booze. Starting off with one of our favorite interviewees, Tony Abu Ghanim, who is Mr. Cocktail, Mr. Whiskey.
And Mr. Spirits, generally.
And Mr. Spirits in general.
And the head judge or something like that, he'll explain, of an event that takes place every year in San Francisco called the World Spirits Competition. And he talks not about what the not only about what the competition is about, but what he thinks is coming down the pipe, what it is we'll be drinking now, what it is we'll be drinking in the future. Always has a strong opinion and a very well-informed opinion on that subject. Then we're going to touch on the revival of what many people would have described as a dying drink, namely vermouth. And then we're going to finish up with good old craft beer. So that sounds like a good roundup for the day. So let's get going with Tony, huh? We were just talking with our guest, Tony Abu Ghanim.
Why don't you let me do that? The wonderful old character called
Booker No, who was one of the spokespersons for the Jim Beam Company and launching their wonderful series of single barrel bourbons. And he said, "I've been drinking single barrel bourbon for 50 years." He said, I do that every day. Now Tony has the next best job because he's a leading judge. Top judge, what was the term you used, Tony?
I'm the director of judges for the San Francisco World Spirits Competition.
There you go. So you're licensed to imbibe as much booze as you would like from morning till night. And you said at the recent competition, which spanned 4 days, about how many samples did you try?
We were just under 1,600 total samples this year submitted, and each judge will evaluate between 300 and 350 of these submissions over the course of the 4 days.
Now, what's covered with the spirits? Are they just U.S. spirits, or are they spirits from around the world? What are the entrants like?
Well, Peter, it's open to anyone worldwide, so suppliers throughout the world. Several years ago, we received a vodka that won the double gold best of show from Canada that wasn't available in the United States, and to the best of my knowledge, still isn't available in the United States.
Oh, dear.
But a lot of new brands, it's a great opportunity if they show well at San Francisco World Spirits Competition to use that as a launching pad, if you will, for their product, especially here in the United States.
But in a way, is it a little bit like the London Cheese Show, which is the London Cheese Show, but it's really recognized as the world's leading cheese show? Is San Francisco Spirits the same thing?
I would say so, Peter. I think there is a great spirits competition held in London as well. I'm not sure. To me, it sounds like spirits and cheese would go good together. But as far as in the United States and recognized worldwide, the San Francisco World Spirits Competition is got to be at the top of the list, yes.
Now, it is spirits specifically. So it's not wines, it's not things like vermouth and sherry and that kind of thing. It's booze.
Well, we do evaluate vermouths, okay, but it is all spirit. There's a separate San Francisco wine competition. We don't do anything with wine. We don't do anything with beer. Sherry hasn't entered in yet, but I think sherry would be a great addition, as would Madeiras. What we're really starting to see now, especially in the United States with the movement in craft distilling. Today there are nearly 500 licensed distilleries in the United States. So a lot of these new craft distillers are bringing their products to be evaluated and judged at San Francisco World Spirits Competition.
So there are categories for the craft ones as opposed to the major brands?
We haven't really separated major yet. Problem is, I don't know really what the true definition
of
craft is.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah, I even tried to get somebody to give a definition of craft beer, and I couldn't get it.
Well, no, what the person said was that it's really based on how much you make. So below a certain amount, if you like, the licensing rules are different, and you are artisanal and craft rather than a major brewer like Budweiser. Now, as far as craft distilleries are concerned, I'm guessing that they're operating with a license that allows them only to make a certain amount of stuff. We have two or three here in the Pittsburgh area. Portland, Oregon has something like 12 or 15 within the city limits. But I think that they get their license based on the fact they're only going to produce a certain amount.
Which is a very interesting point, because there's it becomes almost these esoteric brands, which are fabulous, but you're not going to tell me that a distillery that's been making whiskey for 3 years is able to make it better than someone like Jim Beam, who's been making it since the turn of Prohibition and has roots dating back prior to Prohibition. And
no,
I love this, the whole idea of the craft distiller, and the movement is fabulous. But again, it's interesting when we judge some of these whiskeys. I say, I bet you give this whiskey another year, 2 years in the barrel, and it'll really have time to develop. And I think this is what we're seeing in the craft, especially with whiskeys. A lot of these products are coming to market too soon because, they've got to start turning a profit selling some of their whiskey that has been aging now maybe 2 years or a year, not meeting technically the qualifications of a straight bourbon whiskey. So it's going to be an interesting time, Peter, to see the next few years how all the craft distilleries play out. And possibly that will be something we do at San Francisco, is separate craft. But right now, it's pretty much all judged together.
Well, Tony, that partially addresses an issue question I was going to ask you, is in addition to there getting to be more and more and more distillers, overall, do you see the quality rising, like for the competition?
I would definitely say that the quality overall continues to rise. A great place, again, spirits coming from all over the world to be recognized. A double gold at San Francisco really solidifies all your hard work. And I think on the other side, if you don't show well in San Francisco, maybe it's a message, I should take a look at this product. It allows the manufacturer to say, maybe I'm not on with my gin yet. Maybe I need to reformulate it. So there's a lot of positives that come out of the results. Even if you don't show well, sometimes we get very attached to our product, and we think it's the greatest thing, and then it goes in front of a panel of experts, and they taste it blind. And that's one of the beautiful things in San Francisco, is you have no idea what you're tasting brand-wise, just that this is a gin, this is the proof of the gin, that's it. And you're judging solely and evaluate what's in the glass. So it's really, sometimes the feedback can be a little bit harsh, but it's brutally honest.
Well, I was looking at this single malt scotch. Now, that has to be a really tight competition. And I must say that I have never heard of the winner, Craig Ella. What, do you know what it, how you pronounce it? Craig Ella Chi. Craig Ella Chi.
You'd have to send me that. I'm not picking up on it. But that's the beautiful thing, though, Anne, is in Scotland. I mean, it's one of the hardest categories to judge because there's so many amazing malt whiskey. You'll see that's probably the category that scores the most gold and double gold medals.
It also got best in show whiskey.
And that, for a whiskey that you don't know, maybe it's not even available here in the United States yet, but what a great opportunity to market your brand and launch it here in the United States.
So $300 a bottle.
Well, you better drink
I'll
it.
Never
better,
be able to drink that.
Better drink it carefully, huh? Well, let's talk a little bit. We always like to pick your brain, and I'm sure our audience is less interested in you regaling how much you drank and how good it was, but they're more interested in finding out about, from now forward, what is happening that's new and different in all the different segments of the spirits market. And let me give you just an example. I think if I were to look at Scotch over the last 10 years or so, one of the things that is clearly happening is rediscovery of the different woods in the barreling, so that you're seeing sherry casks and bourbon casks, but you're also seeing other kinds of casks and blends made out of whiskies that have been matured for a long period of time, sometimes as long as 20 years, in a wood that 20 or 30 years ago would have been unfamiliar.
You're absolutely right, Peter, and I think the whiskey category overall is probably where the most excitement is. We've already talked a little bit about craft distilling here in the United States, and I think in the next 5 to 10 years, some of these whiskeys that have been in the barrel just a short time will be ready and be mature, and they're going to hit the market, and there'll be some beautiful American whiskeys. But with Scotch, since you mentioned that, I think, you know, Scotch kind of laggard for a long time, and through finding some of these hidden gems and trying different woods and small suppliers, like Anne said, she's never heard of the winning best of show Scotch. A lot of these are now being introduced to the United States. And I think it's to stay competitive with the Japanese, for one. There's some
Beautiful Japanese Scotches. Like every time we have a spirit writer on the show, they bring up that the best single malt Scotch in Japan.
Oh yeah, even though they can't call it Scotch, they, you know, single malt whiskeys coming out of Japan, gorgeous, always score wonderfully in San Francisco, and just a pleasure to drink, and still, for the most part, in an affordable price range where you can enjoy them. What we're seeing happen in Ireland, the Irish whiskey movement is exploding now. You know, we've always thought of Jameson when we think of Irish whiskey, but you know, we have single malts coming out of there. We have peated malt, singles. So the category overall is so diverse in Ireland, and I think we're seeing a lot of these bottlings come to market as well.
I have an interesting observation for you, Tony, which would be different than probably something you ever thought of. But I grew up in the United Kingdom, and one of the things that the United Kingdom always struggled with was what can we export in order to be able to get foreign currency to be able to operate as a nation. And people don't understand just how huge, in terms of the UK economy, the sale of whiskey overseas is. I mean, it's an absolutely huge quantity. It's more than they sell cars. It's more than they sell airplanes. It's more than they sell lots and lots of things. It's really, truly an absolutely vitally important part of the whole economy. So it's really a great thing that people are being innovative and, as a result, attracting attention back to a product which was certainly not increasing in the quantity that was being sold. Now, I want to follow that same thought through American whiskey. And we were talking before we came on the air. People were ringing the death knell, brown spirits in the United States in the 1970s and the 1980s, when all the rookie drinkers decided that all they wanted to do was get looped. So they drank vodka because it doesn't taste of anything. And now the reverse is happening, and all of a sudden American brown whiskies from all over the country are attracting a whole lot of attention, and there's a reemergence of a movement that says this is wonderful stuff.
I could not agree more, Peter.
There you go. See?
No, absolutely right. And I think it was 1976 where vodka surpassed whiskey as the number one consumed spirit in the United States, and it has never looked back since. Vodka continues to account for over 25% of all the spirits sold in the United States. And I think it's a generational thing as well. The younger drinkers, and that was a bad time in the American bar, the 70s and early 80s, the late 60s, that was a bad time. And today, you know, thanks to this resurgence in the craft of bartending, the resurgence in fresh craft cocktails, and resurrecting a lot of these drinks that date back prior to Prohibition, which decimated our craft, when rye whiskey was really the cocktail go-to, the Manhattan rye whiskey, the Sazerac rye whiskey drink. We saw a shortage in rye whiskey because we weren't prepared for this resurgence in American straight rye whiskey. So today you have a selection of rye whiskeys that never existed. That was started bartending in the 80s, you'd be lucky to see a bottle of Jim Beam Yellow Label rye whiskey. And today the offerings are huge. And I think a lot of that was driven by the craft cocktail movement. And again, you're seeing bottlings from the big players that never existed, and new brands that are coming in or being resurrected that didn't exist. There was no market for them. And today, American whiskey could not be hotter.
Right. We love the products from Michter's.
Yeah. Beautiful
the
stuff.
The guy bought. He essentially bought the label and found the recipes, and then started making these products all over again in Louisville, Kentucky, rather than in Pennsylvania. And he's really done an absolutely terrific job.
Yeah, we like them. They keep sending us.
Yeah, well, I wish we're out right now. I wish they'd send us some more.
Maybe they're listening.
One last thought.
I wanted to ask reading through all the whiskeys that were sampled.
We're keeping a man away from his booze, you realize.
Yeah. I noticed two things that I thought, wasn't this interesting? The one is you had Calvados, VSOP, in a category, and the other one is Pisco. And, they've always been predicting that Pisco gets hot, but I don't know that it's really appreciated widely. Do you?
Anna, I could not agree more with you. I just came back from Peru. I was there on behalf of Palm Peru, which is the tourism board.
Yeah, they took us there too.
Fabulous. I mean, just totally changes your whole perception of this artisanal spirit. It's just, I'm on board. I'm all in on Pisco. Anyone who's not making a great Pisco sour is really missing out on a fabulous drink experience to share with their guests.
Yeah, didn't you love, you were in Lima with Palm Peru, mainly?
Yeah, Lima was great. Yeah. I visited several of the distilleries. I mean, the people were just, talk about the nicest people in the world.
Yes.
Welcome you into their home and cook you dinner and drink with you and just the hospitality.
The food is fabulous, isn't it?
Fabulous.
Yes.
And such a diverse category. Just in Peru alone, you have 8 different grape varietals. You know, you have aromatic and non-aromatic. You have puros and you have most de verdos. I mean, you have stylistically different, and they all work differently in different types of cocktails. But the Pisco Sour is just such a lovely, simple drink.
It is. I don't even like cocktails, and I like them a lot. So anyhow, I'm glad you are in favor of Peru and Pisco. What about Calvados? I didn't think anybody ever sipped Calvados anymore.
I think if I had a crystal ball, Anne, and I had to make a prediction, I think Calvados, to me, end of the meal, I always ask, do you have a Calvados?
Do you really?
I love Calvados. I've never been to Normandy. This is a trip I have to make. But I fell in love with Calvados years ago, and have just it is my go-to brandy at the end of a meal. And I've also incorporated it into cocktails. It shows beautifully.
Oh, that would be good, yeah.
Green apple martini phase. Thank God that's over.
Yeah, I forgot about that, yeah.
Yeah, let's put that to rest.
That was not good.
But I was making Calvados cocktails, and people just, where's the fluorescent green? It's like, just taste it. Fresh lemon juice and Calvados, you're going to love it. A little honey, beautiful drink. And, that is good. But again, I think it comes down to awareness, and it comes down to being able to educate our guests and get them to try something. Like I said, I've never made someone a Pisco Sour that they haven't tasted and said, wow, this is delicious. What is it?
Yep. Yeah, we carried a wonderful bottle of Pisco to Peter's brother in Cornwall, England.
Yeah, I even gave him. They have a special glass to go along with it. It's a little bit like a grappa glass.
Yeah.
So I took those, and they survived. Thank goodness they survived the journey home from Peru, and then the onward journey to England. That was pretty good fun, and it's been great fun talking to you again, Tony. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Tony, I have so many more things to talk to you about. I have to talk to you again soon.
Well, and we'll just have to do it again real soon. We'll do it over a couple Pisco Sours. Peter, it's always a pleasure talking with you, my friend.
Oh, dear, Tony. And carry on. You sound like you're having a good time.
Well, it's, you know, one cocktail at a time, Ann.
All right, Tony. Ciao, ciao.
Stay with us for Vermouth after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And welcome back. And our next guest will prove to us, or at least lead us to understand, why vermouth is more important than just a condiment in a martini.
Yeah, it's not only is it making a comeback, but and not only is Adam an expert on the subject, but he's such an expert he decided to make his own, which I believe is pretty good. We're not going to count how many decades ago it was, but Anne reports that once upon a time when she lived in the city of Florence, or Firenze as the towns like to call it, her tipple before dinner was a glass of a product that subsequently almost disappeared from sight called Cinzano. And we have an expert on the show today with us, Adam Ford, who knows not only why Cinzano was invented, why it was so great, why it fell into disrepute or disrepair or disappearance, and now it's coming back. This is a fascinating story that goes all the way back to pre-Christian China. But where would you like to begin, Adam?
Well, let's give the name of the book.
And oh, okay.
The author, of course,
Vermouth,
is Adam Ford. The title of the book is Vermouth, the revival of the spirit that created America's cocktail culture. And it's a sensational book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was, I put, as I guess all, you know, most writers do, really my heart and soul and certainly all of my time for several years working on it. And it's just such a fascinating story. And even more, what to me was what the really interesting part of it is that it's a story that had never been told. There really, no one's ever kind of dived, you know, done a deep dive into the actual history of vermouth. You see it written about, and you seem to still see kind of popping up the same stories about it, or this kind of idea or myth that it's a product of unknown origin, and it's not exactly clear why it's named what it's named, or why Carpano, when he invents it, what he's trying to do. There's all this kind of, you know, and nobody knows what's in it. You know, most people don't even know that it's a wine base. And so there's all this kind of myths and this kind of shroud over vermouth. And what I was hoping to do, and I think I succeeded to a large extent, was really to kind of peel back that veil and show people this entire category, its rich history, how it's produced, and kind of offer people about every piece of information that I could uncover.
But you fell in love with it, which is the start of this quest, the journey you took into creating it, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Looking back on it, it almost seems, you know, like it was written almost like a fairy tale. But my wife and I, back in right around 2007, 2008, we were hiking, decided to get away, did a hike of the Tour du Mont Blanc. And when we were about 9 days in, we stopped off at this little Italian resort town called Courmayeur, which is up in the Aosta Valley in the Piedmont region of northwest Italy. It's probably one of the most beautiful places on earth, and it's this cute little ski town. And my wife, who is Italian-American, grew up drinking vermouth. I'm also part Italian, but my family was, the vermouth was not much of a tradition. I was kind of a traditional American in my approach to vermouth, which is that I thought it was something you absolutely did not put in a martini. And I loved the jokes about kind of nodding towards France or waving it over the cocktail glass. But my aunt had grown up drinking it, and when we were there in this little, you know, piazza, we noticed other people were drinking vermouth, and Glynis insisted that I try a glass, and I tried it, and as you said at the start of the question, completely fell in love with it. It was unlike, frankly, it was just unlike anything I'd ever drank. We were, we drank a fair bit of wine by that point in our lives. Obviously, it had some cocktails, and there were some craft spirits coming on the scene. Things were getting to be higher quality, but there was just something about this bitterness and this kind of exotic flavor and exotic mouthfeel that just kind of blew me away. And so, and it was a wonderful night and a wonderful trip. And so I was just filled with all of these really positive emotions about the drink. And I figured when I came back to the United States that I would be able to go out and buy a bottle like that and kind of recreate that experience. As it turns out, when I got back to the United States, I quickly realized, I guess, what I knew before, which is that there really were no kind of, really kind of quality vermouths that were meant to be drank on their own in the United States at this time, or at least certainly not in any sort of wide distribution. And so it was, after we got back and there's nothing there, and I kind of forgot about it and went on with my life. And as the next couple of years rolled by, I started seeing, all this really great craft spirits being created, obviously the craft beers, and there was this cocktail movement, and I realized nobody had done that to vermouth. Like, everything was getting an upgrade by people using, taking the ethos of the slow food movement and the locally sourced idea.
Yeah.
Nobody had done that to vermouth, and so I spoke with my wife, and we decided we were going to go for it.
So you make a vermouth, and it's a craft vermouth, and it has a funny name.
There's a good meaning behind that funny name.
Go ahead.
Should I tell you? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, sure. Yeah. No. The story. So as it actually ties into the book really nicely. So the name of the vermouth is Atsby, 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 New York vermouth. And where that name comes from is, and I go into this in detail in my book. It's actually my absolute favorite part to write. And as it turns out, the liveliest place in New York City during the 1860s, frankly up to the 1900s, was a strip of bars on Broadway, south of Houston, north of Prince. It's where all the kind of, they were, what happened, they were these concert saloons, and they were called the Assembly Theaters on Broadway.
Uh-oh.
That's what they used to be called. And these Assembly Theaters on Broadway start getting turned into, the first one is in 1859. It's opened by a guy from Philadelphia who moves to the city and opens one called the Melodeon. And it is basically where cocktails start getting invented. And these bars are kind of opening right at the same time that vermouth is first being imported into the United States and into New York in any sort of quantity. And once it's discovered, all of these bartenders, and the best bartenders in the world, worked along these strip of bars. The highest accolade you could be called was to be called a Broadway bartender.
Yeah.
And guys like Jerry Thomas, who's recently been, canonized through, largely, I think, David Wondrich in his book Imbibe contributes to that. And these other guys, the only William. So they start inventing all of these cocktails, the Manhattan, the Martinez, which becomes the Martini, the Metropole, the Metropolitan. All of these cocktails are being created along this strip in New York. And so when I was formulating Atsby and thinking about creating it, I wanted to pay homage to the original cocktail culture in the United States and kind of pinpoint that spot where vermouth played its largest part.
Let's go back in time just a second, because the remarkable thing for me about the book, aside from the transition that you document so well and that you've been such a big part of, is that the idea of it, if you like, of adulterating wine with herbal substances goes back not to the 1860s, it goes back to the 1860s before Christ, or even earlier than that,
even beyond that.
And I'm really rather intrigued with how that happened. If there's any way that you figured out it happened, but I'm not sure you ever really figured out why.
Well, no, both. I mean, we pretty know. There's this professor by the name of Patrick McGovern, who has written a couple of fantastic books, one of which is called Uncorking the Past. A lot of our understanding of what early human were drinking is due to the fantastic research by a professor by the name of Patrick McGovern, who's published a number of books on the topic and a number of articles, one of which is called Uncorking the Past, which is a really fascinating read. And what McGovern finds, and then others, others that follow him kind of come in support, is that humans from at least 6,500 years, before the Common Era, where people were infusing fermented beverages with different herbs and spices, and we wind up finding trace amounts in various provinces in China from around that time period, from 6,500 to 4,800 and throughout, of fermented of wine that's been infused with chrysanthemum and various other kind of local herbs and spices. And, to answer your question of why were people doing that, there was really two reasons, which were at that time really interlaced. One, adding these herbs and spices actually contributed to the flavor in a positive way. Some people argued that it was a way of masking off wine or bad wine at the time, but that's not clear. In fact, there's a lot of evidence supporting the opposite, that you're not masking wine, but you're actually just improving the flavor of it. The other reason, which is really fascinating, is that also people came to understand by this time period that herbs and spices had certain positive health benefits as well. So we see it as showing up as kind of a early on, it's more of a ceremonial drink meant for kings and the aristocracy. And then I think by about 3000 BC, you start seeing evidence of these aromatized wines in jars in just regular homes. And that's kind of a really amazing part in the drinking of history, because by that time, it's not just reserved for the nobility, but the kind of more common people or peasants, as they were called at the time, would have been drinking it as well.
But if you fast forward now to the middle of the Renaissance era or just after, then
yep.
Now you see vermouth as having a medicinal component more than a liquor component.
Well, I'm not positive that I agree with that statement. Yeah, no, I know a lot of a lot of people have written on this and have suggested that vermouth is first and foremost a medicinal product. As it turns out, during the Renaissance, the state of knowledge was such that people, one, they still believed in the four humors, which was the bile and there was this idea, right? And so there's this idea that everything you should be drinking and eating should be contributing to your health. But there was not, and this was just like the way there was all these cookbooks that were coming out during the Renaissance, and there was at the time there was not really a distinction between what you were doing for health versus what you were doing for pleasure. The two were completely interlaced. They were really one and the same. So people were not drinking, I trace in the book that vermouth has these predecessors called Hippocras, and before Hippocras was Conditum, and before that was Mulsum, which are all just different styles of aromatized fortified wines. But all of those drinks are being served at the banquet table, and they're being served in connection with is kind of the banquet dining of the aristocracy. And these are drinks that are clearly being drank, not just because they believe there's the medicinal qualities, but because they're really delicious as well. So it's certainly true that people were drinking aromatized wines because it was for their health, but they were drinking it just as much because it was a delicious product that they were drinking. So, and that's kind of a novel idea that I argue in this book.
Yeah, I remember that argument. I couldn't remember how you came down on it, and that's why I mentioned it. Now, interestingly enough, let's get back to the modern era interest in vermouth. And my good lady wife, Anne, who loves most things to drink, only likes sweet vermouth for making one thing, which is Anne's favorite mushroom soup.
which is not really mine. It's Vincent Price's.
No, well, whatever, just, yeah, the guy just died.
He didn't just die. He's just now, he's been dead, but they are just now setting up some kind of a, an exhibition.
He was
also an artist.
Okay.
And he was also, they have a special edition of his book, his cookbook coming out. And I was going to actually, his daughter is putting it out, and I was going to ask her, are you including this mushroom soup, which I picked up like when I was in college, and I, you know, I copied it out of somebody else's book. It wasn't even my own cookbook. And I've modified it over the years, but I've never had anything be so successful. The secret ingredient is 2 tablespoons of sweet vermouth.
I believe it. I believe it.
Now, Anne's also a believer in at least waving the cork from a glass of dry vermouth. So
of course.
So tastes are changing. Can you take a stab at why you think that?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things contributing to that statement. Tastes are certainly changing, and I think American as a whole, our palates are really evolving. I mean, the recent boom in bitters.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And bitter vegetables, too. We interviewed McLaughlin on that.
Yeah. Sure, yep.
That's a fabulous book called Bitter.
And
they're putting savories and desserts. I mean, it's certainly evolving.
Absolutely, yeah. So on one hand, you really do have a maturing of the American palate. You also have at the same time a real interest by people in knowing what exactly they're putting in their bodies. Right? What are they eating? What are they drinking? They want to know the story behind it. They want to know that it's sustainable. They want to know that it's good for them, much like people during the Renaissance in Europe, actually. And then in the past 4 or 5 years, we have all of these new vermouth producers that are making products that are meant to be drank on their own, the way vermouth was originally made to be drank. And they're using, Andrew Quaddy really kind of starts it in the 1990s, 1999 anyway. You know, I talk about Andy, and I think his products are really, really delicious. I think they're a high-quality American vermouth. He obviously makes them on his winery out in Madeira County, and he really kind of starts it in 1999. Although, truth be told, I think his vermouths are kind of what I refer to as kind of an imitation style of the traditional sweet and dry. But after Andy, you have this really great guy, Carl Sutton, out in the dog patch of San Francisco, and Carl starts making this, just a year. 10 years later, in 2010, this dry vermouth that is really fascinating to drink. Drink it. You have no idea what's going on. You have no idea anything that's in it. He does a masterful job of blending things. Again, all locally sourced wines and brandies. Imbue up in the Willamette Valley comes online the next year. And that's the first time that you see a vermouth producer really focusing, naming the type of grape that they're using. They use a Pinot Gris and then a brandy from one of the local distilleries. I launch at, and they were, start using brandy from a local distillery, and then the following year, 2012, I wind up launching Gatsby Vermouth, which is really the first time that someone's using a vintage Chardonnay. Well, one of the noble grapes,
hold on just a second, Adam. So the brandy you're talking about is what's fortifying the wine.
That's right. Okay. Under U.S. law, you have to use a brandy, right? A fruit-based spirit to fortify the vermouth. And if we could just go off on a slight tangent for a second, that's actually one of the reasons. There's a lot of debate also about the American legal definition of vermouth and the European legal definition of vermouth. And I always argue that I prefer the American version for numerous reasons, but one of which is that it requires, under U.S. law, the fortifier to be a fruit-based brandy.
Okay.
And that results in using a higher quality brandy. The European producers are actually permitted to use anything they want, which means some of them I believe anyway, are using, and I think they've stated it, are using a neutral grain spirit, which is not
lab
a type
alcohol.
Of quality. Exactly.
Doesn't sound like it's in the best interest, does it really? Except to the bottom line, I guess.
That's it. Well, that's exactly right. No, that's exactly right. Because you can buy some Everclear and very easily bump up the proof of your vermouth, but it doesn't necessarily contribute to its quality at all. So, with Atsby, just to get back to what Atsby does in terms of using the vintage Chardonnay, and then we start using an apple brandy, from one of the craft distillers. We start using, to sweeten it, a raw summer honey, locally sourced from upstate New York. And for the drier one, and then the sweeter vermouth, this caramel, a really high-quality caramel made from dark Indian muscovado sugar. We're then followed by an uncouth vermouth, another terrific producer out in Brooklyn, made by this woman, Bianca Moralia. And Bianca makes some really terrific vermouths, and her whole thing is not just using very high-quality wines and fortifiers, but all of her botanicals are also locally sourced and in many cases hand foraged. So to get back to the original question about why are people getting into vermouth, I think you have the confluence of events between Americans' palates changing, to get into more interesting, more complex, more bitter flavors. I think you've got more of an interest in where your food is coming from and in the products being more locally sourced. And then you have the actual producers that are actually producing those sorts of products that people are interested in.
There's so much that in this book that's beyond even this. We haven't even begun to address the issue of once you were in this position of creating vermouth, you then were invited to make all these wacky cocktails.
Well, and
you have recipes for those in this book,
well,
too.
The key thing
and
is...
Sure, it's a really very good book.
Yeah, you have to take the book with you to the bar. I mean, there's no question about it. And we certainly thank you for keeping On the Menu's listeners up to date, drinking-wise. It's always very important. We thought we were onto a winner when we just read the title. But as we got more and more into the book, we realized you were really onto something. And we wish you continued success with being onto something.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is really, really fantastic. I really enjoyed speaking with you too.
I'd love to talk to you much longer. So when you're in town next, let's try some of this at a bar.
I think that's a great idea. I will certainly take you up on that.
Okay.
You're going to be fantastic. Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks
Adam.
So much, Peter and Ann. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Adam Ford, okay. The book is Vermouth.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
LeBeau sure started out on a major, major project we had, right?
Yes, indeed.
He decided...
But fun.
he decided he was going to tour these United States completely and select some of the best craft beers in every single one of them. How about that for a challenge? And then he put the results together in a book so that you'll know where to go when you go. Jess LeBeau, who's our guest just now, welcome to the program, first of all.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And today you're in Poland, and yesterday you were in Shanghai, which is not in Poland.
I was last week. I was in Shanghai. Yesterday I was in Krakow, and today I'm in Warsaw.
Okay.
And then
now, where are you really from?
I'm originally from Seattle. I grew up there, right, sort of during the big craft beer boom. You know, the Red Hooks and the Pyramids.
Pike Place Pale Ale was one of my favorites.
Love that beer.
In the early days. And didn't the guy who owned that branch out and start importing Grey Goose vodka? I vaguely remember that he made enough money selling Pike Place Pale Ale and other brews that he was able to get into a different business altogether.
He might have, that I don't know.
But the subject for today is a four-letter word, starting with B. See if you can guess. It's beer.
One of my favorites.
And Jess LeBeau is certainly a beer connoisseur. Would you call yourself a beer expert as well?
I've been known to call myself a beer expert, yes.
And, you know, why don't you, you're such an interesting person and complicated. Your day job is really nothing like this at all. How did you get, you were involved with beer when you were in the Pacific Northwest, even though you now live in China. How did you do that?
Well, so I was, when I got out of school, the university, you know, was brewing beer like a lot of people do. You try to brew your own beer. And I was never really very good at it, but I was trying very hard. And when I got out of school, I ended up getting a job working for a beer distributor. So we distributed Budweiser and Red Hook and Heineken and a bunch of other beers. And I'm just a fan of beer, but it was also a really good time to be into trying new things, experimenting with beer, trying new things in the Pacific Northwest. And so I just sort of really got into it. And then eventually moved on from there to writing career because I'd been to, as we talked about earlier, I was a creative writing student when I was at university. And I went on to work for games. So I moved into a company called Wizards of the Coast. I worked on some paper, what we call paper games, you know, role-playing games, card games, and that sort of thing. And eventually that evolved into a video game. And that's what I do now with most of my time with my day job. I travel to different studios around the world writing storylines for video games. And then when I've got 3 to 6 months in one place, I work on a beer book.
It's interesting. I'm going to take you back to, I think it's the 18th century. There was a gentleman in England who set out to do something even more ambitious than what you did, but we'll come back to that in just a second. He decided he would dedicate his life to drinking a pint of beer in every inn in England, Scotland, and Wales. And he was on his second time around when he passed away.
Wow, that is very impressive.
Now, I don't know his name, and I guess I should look him up sometime so that I would actually know that. But you attempted something not quite on the same scale, but equally challenging. And the result is this book called
The United States of Craft Beer,
which involved your crossing the country. I guess you didn't go to every state, but you got beer from every state, and you sampled lots and lots of them, and you decided that you would select the one that you, in your opinion, thought was the best in each state. What an amazing idea.
Could I ask a dumb question first? With all the developments in beer of late, I think that the definition of craft beer has changed. What criteria definition did you use for criteria did you use for defining craft beer?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think there's an official definition of craft beer, and I think it has to do with the number of barrels that are produced each year.
Yeah, I believe that's true.
But personally, I think it has to do with, so what excites me about beer is sort of the experimentation, the trying of new things. It's culinary, right? It's sort of like a good brewer is a little bit like a starred Michelin-starred chef, right? They're trying new things. They're pushing the boundaries. It's an exploration of flavors and of even of history, right? Of trying some things like the Dogfish Head stuff where they're doing all of these beers based on ancient recipes and whatnot. And for me, I think what separates, say, a commercial brewery from a craft brewery is that sense of independence, of experimentation, of the exploration into some new flavor, new thing. You know, these big commercial brewers have, those brews all have their place. Sit down for a big meal and a nice, very cold lager on a hot day is going to really hit the spot. But what they're looking for is consistency, right? Every single can or every single bottle is going to be exactly the same. Whereas some of these small brewers are saying, I'm going to put out one big barrel of beer that I'm going to age in a barrel, and I'm going to try for a different flavor. And that's sort of the excitement. That's what I think the craft brewer is, that spirit of exploration that sets them apart.
Now, it's interesting you should say that. The history of beer we've actually talked about in other programs, but it's still interesting to reflect upon the fact that it was nothing like today's beer, except that it contained alcohol derived from grain. And other than that, I understand from the back leaf of your book that in Egypt, where beer was first produced, we think, it was as much a currency as it was a beverage.
Yeah, one of the best books that I read recently was called The History of the World in Six Cups. I think by Tom Standage. Are you familiar with this book?
No. We should get it, I guess.
It's a really fantastic book, but it basically goes through exactly this idea of the origins of beer and wine and of spirits and coffee, tea, and Coca-Cola, actually, but how the originally there was, you know, didn't have, beer was thought to be just some grain that had been left out and had gotten wet and had fermented with the, you know, natural yeast in the air, and people drank it and they got a little bit of a buzz and they enjoyed this. But then as they started to develop their brewing techniques and they were able to, it's used as a fuel for workers. You'd pay your workers in this beverage because it was nourishing and keep them alive, but also it was an enjoyable thing. And then the higher ups, the supervisors and such, would get paid in larger quantities of this stuff. But it was more than they could conceivably consume on their own. So what they did then is in turn they would hire people to be household servants or people to do services or make things for them, and it became sort of the way of they were to trade for goods and services. And then wine had a similar path, and so did spirits. I totally recommend you go listen to this or listen to or read this book. It goes through it in great detail and is very well researched.
Now, your specific idea, the idea behind this book, how did that come to you? Did it just come to you one day? You just woke up in the morning and said, I'm in this state, I'm going to drink a beer here, and then tomorrow I'll go to another state, and so on and so on?
Well, it's actually my second book. The first one was called The Beer Devotional, and that was, the idea with that was, it was like any devotional, it was one page a day for each date, right? It was a beer and a little quip about alcohol and a sort of pairing for each of the beers. To the day. And then I actually pitched a book called Around the World in 80 Drinks, and the idea was going to be that we were going to go to different places around the world where drinks, you know, the origin of certain drinks. So, for example, you'd go to the Manhattan, right? You'd be in New York, you'd talk about the origin of the Manhattan and then have several different recipes for different Manhattans and some of the history of that. And the publisher there had been several other books with that title, so the publisher didn't end up accepting that one. And then they came back to me with this idea a short while later, and we sort of worked on it together. The initial idea was something they came to me with, but then how we put it together. It's difficult to put together the best brewery in each state, right, because it's just a matter of taste, right? My favorites are not going to necessarily line up with other people's favorites. So what I wanted to do was sort of present a tour guide, right? Like, if you're in these states, here's some things to check out. Here's places to start with.
Well, you did actually pick one as your leader in each state, did you not?
I did, yes. My favorite, yeah.
And in the case of Pennsylvania, for example, it's Victory Brewing in Downingtown, which is a beer producer we know. In Delaware, I actually didn't
Dogfish
look at the Delaware,
Head.
But I'm sure it must have been Dogfish Head.
It is.
And
it was.
Sam was on the program, and he was retelling the story of how he and I think a partner presented themselves in front of some part of the state legislature in Delaware because there had never been any legislation about craft brewing. So they helped the legislature to write it, which seemed like a hell of an idea. He said we were not quite sure where we were going to go next.
It's really interesting you bring that up because a lot of Sam's story and Dr. Ted's story is one of the more interesting, I think, that I've encountered. But a number of different breweries have had the same exact journey through this process because we hit prohibition in America. And prior to that, prior to the bottle cap, we had 2,500 more breweries in America because you couldn't just go to the store and buy a bottle of beer. You had to go to your local pub and it had to be brewed nearby you. And then we hit the temperance movement, hit prohibition, and we dropped from thousands of breweries down to single digits. And then just recently, from the last couple of years, are we back up and now finally up over the number that we had before the Revolutionary War. But the legislation never really caught up. We got the right to be able to create and sell alcohol, but home brewers didn't, because the lobby or the legislators didn't see the need to update those laws for a long time. We didn't. Many of the states, home brewing was illegal. And then you've got laws about how you can produce it. You can be a small brewer and you can produce the beer, but you can't sell your product or sample your product on your own premises. It has to be sold to another premises where they have to have a specific type of license. And a lot of these laws were not thought of in conjunction, how you work, how the industry develops. And now that sort of the industry outside of the big commercial brewers and the craft brewing industry coming up where you want to have your own tap room and you want to be able to have to eat and try the beer on premises. This stuff is evolving to go along, and it's kind of cool. A lot of these brewers are getting involved in the politics of beer.
Let's talk some more about what people are going to find in this book. So we talked about Pennsylvania. Let's pick another state, not Delaware. Let's maybe pick Oregon. Oregon,
okay.
a real hotbed of fine craft
yeah.
beer. Now, what was your pick in Oregon?
My favorite in Oregon is Ninkasi. And I grew up in Seattle, so when Ninkasi hit the scene, I was just a real big fan right away. And you know, one of the things that I like the most about beer is that it's really just about your personal preferences, right? I just don't feel like anybody can tell you what's the right or wrong way to taste or enjoy a beer. I personally like a lot of pale beers. I like hoppy beers, but I like them to have a real dirty, malty backbone to them. And then in Ninkasi, you know, a lot of the hops in America are grown in the Pacific Northwest, particularly in Oregon. So a lot of those beers that have come out of Oregon are very, very hoppy, sort of that's been coined as the West Coast IPAs. The Ninkasi just makes a very well-built, chewy, well-balanced beer with lots of different hop characteristics, but also the malt backbone that can help balance that out, so it's not just a bunch of lip-puckering bitterness.
Now, what about some of the lesser-known states, like maybe North Dakota?
Well, so every state has at least two brewers that are doing, every state has at least two breweries in them. North Dakota, I picked Laughing Sun Brewing in Fargo. I don't know a whole lot about them. I've tried several of their beers, but the what interesting thing about beer in America is that, particularly in the lesser known states, a lot of times these beers are not available outside of their own state or, say, state or two just outside of their borders. So the distribution of these things is quite limited. And so one of the things I was trying to do with the book was give people sort of, you know, goals. Because personally, I've done several road trips and I've gone to several of these breweries and I've gone to try their tap rooms. But if you don't know that Dakota has got a couple of really good breweries, you're not going to know where to go to when you jump in your car and you say, okay, I'm going for one of these road trips.
So now you know. It's really wonderful. You've done a great service. And
well, you give a little history of the brewing company. And then you say why you like it. Then you do around the state. So that means that you give people leads into other parts of the state. And then you give these little green boxes or whatever they are with the rounded edges. You have all these details of, like, Portland has the most breweries of any single city in the United States. Approximately how many millions of barrels of beer were drunk, and all kinds of interesting auxiliary information for this. So you got a pretty good picture.
Here's the deal, listeners. Here's the deal. If you're interested in beer, if you're interested in craft beer, how much does this book cost?
I don't know.
It costs less than a case of craft beer. So it would be an awfully good investment to make sure you're heading in the right direction. I just want to close with one thing. I want to ask your opinion on something that we thought we discovered that was something that we didn't realize before. And I'd like to see if you agree or you don't agree. The beer in question, curiously enough, is Pilsner Urquell. And the producers of Pilsner Urquell do something very interesting. The original brewery still remains, and right beside it is a giant new one. But every so often, quite frequently, they will have someone taste the beer from the new brewery versus the beer from the old brewery and make sure it's still the same. And we were told that something like 160 years ago, the founder of Pilsner Urquell was the guy who finally figured out how to make clear beer. But he told us something else that was interesting. He said beer is supposed to be drunk out of a glass. It's not supposed to be drunk straight out of the bottle or the can. And we've had people go on beyond that. Jane Payton, who was on the show not too long ago, said not only a glass, but you better know what kind of glass is appropriate. But what do you think about that?
Well, I just love trying anything culinary, right? I love food. I love beverage. I love these sorts of things. And so I could sit and try this sort of thing for hours and hours and hours and talk about this sort of stuff. I love it. I love the idea of trying beer from different breweries. I love the idea of that bread baked in different locations by the same bakers with the same recipes, but because the yeast in the sealing boards is different, gives it different flavors. I love the idea that if you put, and I have a collection of wine glasses, right, you know, for different varietals. I love the idea that beer should have varietal glasses. I love the idea that consuming your beer isn't just thirsty or trying to get a little bit of a buzz, that you're trying to really explore that flavor, right? Where you start with a beer at either at room temperature or maybe even cold and let it slowly warm up and try it over time to see how it develops, how the flavor changes. And trying beers, the same beer from a different distributor, from the same brewer every year to see how it, if it's the same. I've even thrown some beers in my wine cellar to see if they would transform over a couple of years.
And
done some experiments. Yeah. And it was really fun experiment. I'll give you the cliff notes on this. It does mellow quite a bit. But I can't tell you that I felt like it evolved to the point where it was worth the time to put it in the cellar. Though the IPAs that I threw in the cellar sat on for 4 years, and they didn't go bad at all. They were just as drinkable as they were when I first put them in there. You could tell a noticeable softness on the edges of the flavors, but it wasn't quite as drastic as, say, you know, a Bordeaux or something.
Well, you've been a delight as a guest, Jess.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine what you're going to write about next about beer, but I'm sure you have an idea in mind, and when that comes to fruition, you must join us again. And
I would be honored to.
And in the meantime, it's time in Poland where you should be probably on your second beer, so why don't you go off and do that, and we'll say goodbye and bottoms up.
Great. Bottoms up. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the time.
Jess, it's great talking to you. Very interesting. The United States of Craft Beer is the book. Jess LeBeau is the author.
Not going to line yourself up with a cocktail or a glass of vermouth or one of America's great craft beers right after the program. I don't know what else we can do to influence you in that regard. But whatever you choose, we hope you'll choose to join us again. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.